are back with episode 603 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and judging from the news, apparently the entertainment industry has entered its silly season as well.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm looking forward to some of the silly.
And this is Brunson from Australia, and really, fucks, that's just mean.
Oh, and wait until you see what we mean by that. Anyway, yes, we are going to be starting off with what is actually a fairly small, very tiny amount of news from the past week, and then we're going to catch up with 2 weeks' worth of episodic discussion, and then we'll get into whatever topics we happen to pull out of our little bag here. But before we do any of that, Edmund, if there's any type of general disclaimer you want to give?
Certainly. We will spoil you about a few things that happened this week, but we hope you'll enjoy it.
There you are. So let's see. Why don't we start off with something that is fairly good news here? Ronstone?
I would love to do that if my computer would just stop being a pain. wonders of technology. So yeah, there was some news came out of the recent ABC event that ABC has reportedly ordered a pilot for the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. spin-off/companion series, starring Adrian Pilecki's Mockingbird and Nick Blood's Lance Hunter, who, if you're a fan of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. like us, you've got to like at least one of those characters. And this was the spin-off that was apparently they were kicking the idea around a few months ago. It looked like it had been dropped, possibly in favor of it. I think we theorized it might have come down to a decision between giving Agent Carter another season or commissioning this. But yeah, apparently the series is going to be called Marvel's Most Wanted. It's going to be a dramatic action series. According to Variety, ABC doesn't know when the series would premiere or how Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. might set it up. Although, the title I find interesting. I'm not sure how I necessarily feel about this. I do like both of these characters, but I think if I'd wanted a spin-off series of this sort of ilk, I would be more interested in something that was a solo Mockingbird thing, because I think she's was a great introduction in the second series of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. She didn't suffer exactly, but was one of those characters who was just like immediately out of the gate awesome enough that I wanted to see them have like some real solo adventures rather than being part of the ensemble. And so the idea of like having a show in which she's, you know, the main character is interesting, but then you throw Hunter in there and it's, I don't know, it feels like it seems like it would be a slightly different vibe than the kind of thing that I would want. But then again, I don't work in Hollywood, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, from the comic book side, of course, Mockingbird was married to Hawkeye, and they did do a few miniseries, and they had a nice sort of romantic tete-a-tete sort of back and forth, not quite arguing, but definitely a heated exchange every once in a while, that type of thing, let me do it, no, I already got it type of thing. And it worked well, and I'm hoping they're basically going to carry that over into these miniseries. Marvel's particularly good at grabbing good chunks of comic book storyline and throwing them into these into the television shows. So I'm hoping that's going to be their inspiration.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to add to that one in particular. I think that good points made all around. That's it for the network news, though, as far as I can see here. But there is some movie news. Edmund? This one's interesting.
There are some of those projects you hear about and you wonder why people haven't done them before, and
I'm not wondering that, actually.
No, that didn't occur to me.
And then there are projects like this. For those who have been wondering where that Zorro Reborn film with a futuristic Zorro adventuring in a post-apocalyptic era is, I'm pleased to tell you that after 15 years in development hell, it has apparently been greenlit again.
I'm just going to mute myself, excuse me.
Here's the thing, though. The reason I'm laughing is because I'm just like, that sounds bug stuff. I want to see this.
I think it's great we broke Gary.
I mean, honestly, it's just such... It seems so ridiculous, that there's really only two ways it could go. It's going to be a complete pile of horse turd, or it's just going to be so bat stuff crazy awesome.
Yeah, well,
it's going to be the kind of thing that, like, you sit down with some mates or something and crack a beer and watch, and just one way or another, you'll enjoy it.
Absolutely, this has MST3K written all over it from the get go. But I'm thinking it might be this generation's Ice Pirates, which covers both bases. So.
Wow, that's a bad hit against that. And I like Ice Pirates.
Now, Gary, yes, I understand that you and your family enjoy Disney's Jungle Cruise.
Not only do we do it, we actually got a standing ovation from the skipper when we were in Disneyland last month as we did our own little sort of heckling slash throwing our own words into the skit. Because as we found out, both Disneyland and Disney World use pretty much the exact same script. So we've been punning Disney World for years. So as soon as we started to hear the same script, my children and I looked at each other and we knew we were in for fun.
Well, it sounds like you're in for even more fun.
Oh, yes, we are. And unlike the last one that left us cringing, this one my kids and I are really looking forward to. What we're talking about is yet another Disney movie based on a theme park ride. In this case, as John said, the Jungle Cruise film. It was talked about years ago when the Pirates of the Caribbean movies were first getting started, but it never seemed to go anywhere. Perhaps maybe that's from the other movies that sort of bombed out and they just let it lie fallow. Well, it's popped its head again, and the moving star for it is going to be Dwayne Johnson. His star has really taken a shine in Hollywood lately between his movies that have been doing well. He has an HBO series currently going, so his career is definitely on the upswing again. And so they've sponsored him in this. Just so you sort of get an idea, for those who haven't been on the Jungle Cruise, you're on a small steamboat that holds about 20, 30 people, and you're going through the wilderness, and you're exposed to animals and some natural features like waterfalls and the such. And it's set to be a very hokey thing with extremely corny jokes, at least on the ride. And they're going to I don't know about the corny jokes per se, but they are going to make it a period piece. It's going to be set sort of like in the 1950s, for those of you who like that sort of African queen vibe, or just, you know, that sort of undiscovered country where you're not 5 minutes away from talking to somebody in a cell phone, and you're going to be going down the river. So my family is looking forward to it. We sort of always like that that sort of 50s genre, especially just a touch on the corny side. So I'm looking forward to it. I think they could do good work. You know, some of the past movies they've done, like Haunted Mansion with Eddie Murphy and stuff like that, have bombed. And I have a sense that maybe they're starting to get the hang of some of these movies a little bit better. Disney movies have been getting more and more critical praises over the years. So hopefully this will follow that track.
Now let's see. Speaking of Disney, as we move over to casting news. It sounds like there's some more Disney news in the casting news area here, Bronstam.
So it appears. So we had the D23 conference, I believe, over this past, the previous weekend, something like that. I'd like to confirm it, but again, my computer is being a pain.
Yes, it was in Anaheim in the last week, as we were recording. Yes, mm-hmm. Sir.
And a number of other announcements came out that we'll get to soon, but one of the slightly more surprising ones was that at the expo, it was confirmed that Orlando Bloom will be returning to the role of Will Turner in the 2017 film Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Want More of Your Cash. I mean, Dead Men Tell No Tales.
They are pirates, after all. I'm fairly sure, no matter how you look at it.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. Apparently filming on the movie wrapped last week. We knew that Johnny Depp and Jeffrey Rush were also reprising their roles as Captain Jack and Captain Barbosa. I didn't realize that also going to be in the film, I apologize if I get this wrong, Kaya Scolidario, who I think probably most well known for being in the first four series of Skins, and Javier Bardem, who, if you don't know, then you're missing out.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting lineup there. Let's put it that way.
Honestly, I haven't really been following the production of this film. I was introduced. The main thing that I knew about this film was that they were making it in Australia, and my government wanted to kill Johnny Depp's dogs.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
I recall that.
I'm not kidding. That's a real thing that happened.
Well, I mean, whatever you want to say about Australia right now.
That's the least douchey thing that the Australian government has done lately. Threatened to kill someone's dogs.
Oh, well, moving on then to something a little less terrifying. We have casting news for Star Wars Rogue One. Yes, we have a couple new people added to the list. One that is, of course, of great interest to you, Bronze Thumb, Mads Mikkelsen from Hannibal, of course, and then Alan Tudyk, known for many things, but we, of course, know him best as Watch from Firefly, or whoever the hell he was in other movies. The...
he played the titular character in iRobot.
Yeah. Funny you mentioned that, because apparently he's going to reuse his old iRobot motion capture skills to be some kind of digital creature in this film.
Is he going to be a pilot?
He might be. It's possible. So, yes, this seems to be a part of the finalized cast list for the film that also includes all kinds of people whose names I cannot currently pronounce. Let's see if I can try. Riz Ahmed, Diego Luna, Felicity Jones, Zhang Wen, Donnie Yen, Ben Mendelsohn, and Forest Whitaker. I actually managed to get everyone, I think, and only mangled maybe two or three. So there we are. Yes, we have a full cast list, it seems. And I guess they've renamed these films from Star Wars Anthology to just Star Wars, A Star Wars Tale or something like that. I don't recall.
I think it's I listened recently to an interview with the screenwriter of Rogue One. It wasn't an interview per se, but he was doing another podcast, and they talked about it briefly. And there is still not an official consensus on whether it's just whether these films are just going to be like Star Wars blank or Star Wars Anthology blank. They're being referred to as both in official circles and memorandum and whatnot.
I will be amazed if the word anthology actually would go into any title.
I seriously doubt that they'll use anthology in any of the titles, but anthology is sort of the umbrella of what these films are going to be. Because from what I remember, they're pitching the second anthology film as being a young Han Solo story.
Mm-hmm.
Young Han Solo?
That's, yeah, I think that's accurate. I don't know.
Well, we had the young Indiana Jones, I think so now we'll have the young Han Solo.
As long as there's no Shia LaBeouf.
I've got bad news.
In more casting news.
Yes.
I don't have a significant problem with Shia LaBeouf, but I just don't want to be reminded of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. I just want to let that live in its own little thing that I don't have to really think about.
No. See, it's going to be young Han Solo, and it's going to be him as a motivational speaker. He's already filmed his green screen parts. It's going to work brilliantly.
Just do it, Chewbacca!
All right, moving on then from that gem. Gary, I believe that Gotham does not have nearly enough villains in it.
No, it's woefully lacking in evil content and people with nefarious motives. So let's throw some more people in there. In this case, as the title pun goes, they're casting a female Firefly. Now, while we would all like to have Fox really not mention Firefly except for either renewal or movie. Since they have brought that up, it's actually has nothing to do with the Joss Whedon series, but rather a longtime Batman villain named Firefly, who basically used a form of flamethrower in the crimes. In this case, however, they put a twist on it, and it's going to be a woman instead of a man. The actress, Michelle Ventimiglia, or Mia, will be joining Gotham as one of the new supervillains, the supervillain Firefly. She comes from a family of arsonists who's sort of been forced into the family business. And so we're going to see what happens. It's sort of the good girl gets pulled into the bad situation, and now she wants to take out all her anger against anyone who's wronged her. So she's going to be in two episodes, back-to-back episodes, the fifth and sixth episodes of season two. And so we have another person out there. She's going to have some relation to Selena, and we'll have to see what that ends up being exactly. And for those of you who are looking forward to it, I don't know if there's anybody on the show host, but the season for Gotham will be starting on September 21st.
Hmm. Okay.
Really? Really, Fox? Really? I mean, you bring back 24, then you bring back X-Files. Mm-hmm. You're talking about bringing back Prison Break, and then you decide, well, let's put Firefly on Fox.
Wait a minute. Haven't you been watching Flash?
That's CW.
It's been back for a while.
Sorry. But yeah, really, really, Fox. This is just mean.
It would this constitute, Bronston, to bring back an old gem, a kick to the heart crotch?
this would be exactly that.
Well, it's at least appropriate. Edmund, I believe that we have a little bit of news about Star Trek Beyond.
Yes, we do. However, as we've come to expect, it is just a little news. But apparently, Lydia Wilson, best known for her role in the romantic comedy About Time, has been added to the cast, joining the returning members of the crew and newcomers like Idris Elba, who is apparently playing the villain, but that is about all that we know. But Ms. Wilson, for those of us more on the TV side of things, has also recently been in such series as Black Mirror, Misfits, and Ripper Street. So some actually pretty decent genre and dramatic cred there.
Yeah, I would say. All right, and I think we finally made it yet another... No.
Not quite.
Gary, I believe you decided you wanted to take this one.
I sure did, because I enjoyed her character in two different shows immensely. The actress that we're remembering tonight is both Batman and, for me, Star Trek's Yvonne Craig passed away after a battle with cancer. She was a rather private person as she reached later years in life, but just what a career she did have, besides being known probably most by most people as the Batgirl role in the 60s, which not only helped revitalize the show a little bit to bring some more of a female audience in, actually helped push to get the character reintroduced into the comic books. There was a few issues in the late 50s where there was a Batgirl, but she had pretty much faded away. And after Yvonne Craig's portrayal on the TV series, Batgirl became popular and back into the comic books again. So all the spinoff comic books you read now about the various Batgirls and probably were even responsible for the Oracle portrayal were all a result of Yvonne Craig's appearance in the TV show back in the 60s. So, you know, she helped bring the renaissance of Batgirl back to the publications. Also, as a side note, she also played Marta, the Orion slave girl, in the third season of one of the Star Trek episodes, Whom the Gods Destroy. And besides that, she her sterling career had her working with Bing Crosby, Don Knotts, George Hamilton, even Dennis Hopper and Elvis Presley. So she had quite a career in her day. So definitely no regrets, I'm sure, on her side, other than, of course, passing. It's received a fair amount of popular appeal from people, and it's, as I go across different social media, it's interesting how many people she actually did touch in one shape or another. So the outpouring was notable.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to be able to add to that one. Anything you guys want to add?
No, I think Gary covered it pretty well, but certainly, for me, I mean, that was, pretty major parts of my childhood on both scores there. The Batman series, I was a regular viewer of when I was a kid, when it was in syndication. And if I remember right, in New York, they actually had, they had a hour block with, George Reeves Superman followed by the Batman show. So,
yes, they did. Yes, they did.
Yeah, okay, well then what we're going to do here is go ahead and hit our mid-show break, and when we come back we're going to get started on the episodic discussion for the week ending the 11th of August, so stay tuned. All right, and as promised, we're going to go ahead and get started with the first set of episodic discussion here for this week's worth of content. And we are starting with the week ending the 11th of August. So let's see here. Let's start with, as usual, the bottom shows of the week. And these came in as low as a 6. And not the show that you probably think came in at 6. But let's go ahead and start here with Dark Matter, Season 1, Episode 9. Episode 9. Four abandons the ship to embark on a reckless mission to reclaim his past, and the crew are left wondering whether they should rescue him or let fate run its deadly course. Well, and this one came in at a dead solid average 7 from all of us. And I don't know about you guys, I just really didn't care at all about what was going on.
It almost felt like a placeholder episode, like they weren't ready to advance the storyline, so they just, you know, threw this in almost this filler. I really didn't feel like I got much more out of this this episode as far as character development like I have in previous ones.
Hmm.
Space Samurai are cool.
Yeah, if they were in space.
That's about all I got.
Well, I thought the few episodes ago when they did that sort of memory bump or whatever, that I felt I got more out of those like minute and a half than I did out of this episode. Mm.
Yeah, this episode, yeah, it had no content. It had nothing that I'm going to care about or latch onto as the show goes forward. It was basically just spending the whole running time reinforcing the things we learned in that, you know, minute and a half of memory dump stuff. Yeah, it is filler in the truest sense of the word.
Yeah, which is unfortunate since, again, they finally started turning a corner and then they went right back to this.
Yeah.
But beyond that, we have also coming in at a dead solid average 7, Falling Skies, Season 5, Episode 7, Everybody Has Their Reasons. The group finds a safe haven in the form of a functional military base run by Weaver's old flame. Meanwhile, plans spin into motion for a final assault on Niashveni, yet it dawns on the second mass that things aren't exactly as they seem. And yeah, I gave it a 7 only for the fact that it's about damn time somebody held the Masons accountable for something, but yeah. It still wasn't a great episode.
Yeah, I mean, I was the one who dipped below 7 because I'm just finding Falling Skies once again reaching that point where they've kind of set up their main conflict and now they're in that spinning their wheels phase and coming up with new conflicts just to hold things up a bit.
Hmm.
Well, I thought a little bit more of it. For the last few seasons, almost, every time the Masons are starting to organize, oh, we're going to get on the radio and every militia in the world is going to rise up and start fighting, coordinate. It was nice for someone to say, wait a minute, you know, how do you know this? Why do you know this? And, you know, as John was saying, it was sort of good that they were held to task, you know, about some of the decisions. And I don't want to quite call it a clip show or anything because it wasn't necessarily that. But at the same time, they did bring up several, you know, different things that had occurred that, you know, I could see a rational person saying, wait, you had eyeworms in you. Wait, you gave birth to a half alien kid. Wait, you you have spikes in you. There could be some alien influence here. Oh, no, there's none. Well, let's see about it. So I thought the premise was good. I thought the acting on the soldier's behalf and the female I think it was a captain, I guess it was, was atrocious. And that's part of what pulled me out of it. I don't think the story itself was bad so much as the acting.
Hmm. Yeah, I can't really add to that. But coming in at the bottom here, Edmund, why don't you do this one so that, you know, certainly names are pronounced correctly?
Absolutely. This is True Detective Season 2, Episode 8, the season finale, Omega Station. In the Season 2 finale, the identity of Casper's killer is revealed and the trail of corruption is exposed as Frank, Ray, and Annie plan their next moves. After feeling like in the episode or two before this, they were sort of finding their feet a little bit, they then just sort of completely lost it for the finale. This is actually another case like The Walking Dead, where they expanded the finale to an hour and a half, and I didn't really see the reason for it, since we wound up having a couple of, you know, rather endless sequences, Frank walking through the desert and then the car chase through the forest that really had me wondering whether it had been 2.5 hours yet during periods of this. So not a distinguished end to a rather problematic season.
Mm. Anything to add to that, Bronstam? apparently not. Yes, this one came in at a 6, obviously, so it was the show at the bottom of our list. In the meantime, let's go ahead and move up to the top 3 for the week. Much better fare, all above average, in one case significantly above average. Guess which one that was, but we'll get to it soon enough. Number 3 for the week was The Last Ship, Season 1. Or Season 2, Episode 9, Uneasy Lies the Head. Chandler and his team set out to find supplies and materials for Dr. Scott's lab, only to tangle with bounty hunters and the Immunes. That's what they're calling them now? Okay. Meanwhile, Rachel's effort to find a spreadable cure depends on the scientist who nearly erased mankind. And this one came in at an average of 8.17. And, yeah, killer ending.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, jeez, that's painful. Yeah, killer, yeah.
But true. Yeah, I really thought that the Rachel's little subplot there culminated extremely well. And I really don't have much of a problem with her tactics, frankly. He kind of was deserving of death the entire time.
That's one thing on this show where there are those times when they don't necessarily deal with shades of gray, and I'm perfectly fine with that in this case. Given the nature of what she did, it's still bringing up some of those thorny ethical issues, but down the road.
I do like that they're able to, that they've been continuing to grow this show since they, quote, discovered the cure. You know, in some ways that could be a dead end to the premise, but the introduction of the Immunes, the supposed takeover of Europe, the organization that the Immunes have on the ground is pretty incredible. And the only thing that does stretch my rationality a bit is that that there are so many Immunes. It just, the number seems a little high, even with the revised figures they came up with for us.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Let's see then. Sorry, I'm reading something at the exact same time, at least trying to get my computer to let me. All right, number 2 for the week, Humans, Season 1, Episode 7. Episode 7. This better not become a trend. Seriously. A desperate Karen hunts down Niska, and the synths stay with the Hawkins family, but Hob is not far behind. And this one came in at an average of 8.33. And Bronstein, what would you say about this particular episode?
It finally delivered something that I've been looking forward to for a few episodes now, which was just putting all of the conscious synths and the whole family, getting them in the same place and letting them all interact and stuff like that, because these have been really the two main groups of characters, and getting them all together, it paid dividends. We had a lot of interesting pairings. We had a lot of not only finding things out, but a lot of good dramatic emotional moments. I think my favorite is still Niska playing with the Barbie dolls. The 180 over the course of those few scenes, and a chance for one of the more violent and unstable characters to show a different side of themselves. I also really like the reveals about who the Karen synth was. We had been sort of been getting clues for a few episodes as to what was going on. I'd personally been wondering whether or not she was as conscious as the other ones, and then finding out that not only she is, but that she has a really strong connection with all the other ones. That was very interesting, and I was left really, really on the hook as to where they're going to take that character next.
Edmund, what would you add?
Certainly covers most of my points. I have enjoyed the way they built up the conscious sense. And also that thing now in the last couple of episodes of setting them up in one particular way, but then twisting those expectations a bit. I think especially now with Karen and Niska's stories more fleshed out, there is some interesting twist. twist there in terms of, as Ron Sumpf has said, Niska appearing to be the more unstable one, but in terms of the nature of the life she's had to live, she may not in fact be the most dangerous one, but it was certainly setting things up for the end with quite a few options still in play, which was good.
Mm. Definitely going into the season finale. So let's see. That brings us up to our number one show for the week. And wow, this one never seems to be up at the top of the list. I don't know how that happened. Bronson, why don't you go ahead and take this?
Alrighty. Hannibal, Season 3, Episode 10, and The Woman Clothed in Sun. Carvings symbolizing the Great Red Dragon are retrieved from crime scenes, casting light on Francis Dolarhyde's warped psyche. Meanwhile, both Dolarhyde and Will seek the wisdom of Hannibal Lecter, and Will reaches out to Bedelia de Maurier.
Yes.
And this one came in at an average of 9.25, so who wants to get started on this one?
Well, I think this might be the first time that Edmund has given an Hannibal episode a higher rating than I have.
Yeah, well, aside from loving the original Blake poem, the fact that one of the most memorable sequences from the book, the tiger encounter, it's obviously been done a few times now, but I thought this was one of the best renditions of it I've ever seen. I mean, both in terms of her reactions to the tiger, but then as well, I mean, Richard Armitage was just extraordinary in his reacting to her, which of course she couldn't see, but could quite possibly feel given the intensity of them.
Hmm.
Thinking on this episode, that wasn't one of the main things that jumped to mind. Not that it wasn't fantastic, but the two bits that really jump out at me was the way that they played Dolarhyde's phone conversation with Hannibal, getting into more of that headspace stuff in a lesser real way than we've normally seen in this show. No one is quite as far out there in their perception of reality as Will Graham has been in the past. But just the fact that Dolarhyde sets it all up. He calls up Hannibal from Hannibal's own office and then sees them sitting across from one another in having a therapy session.
Yes,
was a great way to dramatize that that sequence. It also cuts out a lot of it also cuts out some stuff from in the novel. The way that Dolarhyde gets in contact with Hannibal is a lot more complicated. There's a lot more subterfuge involved, and that subterfuge becomes becomes a really big plot point for a few different reasons. The fact that Dolarhyde sort of bypasses a lot of that and gets to contact Hannibal in this still relatively secure, but also a lot much simpler way. Not only does it create the moments, it's a really good way to dramatize these interactions between the two, but it also means that I believe was at the end of this episode where he gets in contact again, and Hannibal gets Will Graham's address.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm getting a bit muddled up because we've had another episode since we watched this one.
Yes.
In the book. Because of the way that the two were in contact, there was a chance for the FBI to intercept some of the information and react to things in a different way. And the show is taking a lot of perverse delight in having the villains be more competent and more secret and in the way that they communicate, which means that going into this bit of the story, I'm a lot more on edge in a good way. Like I'm having a much more emotional reaction. I'm a lot more afraid for the good guys than I was at this point in the book, because in the book where we're mostly with Will Graham, and Will Graham sort of finds out what these characters have been talking about through means that I won't go into, but here where we know what the villains are talking about, and we also know that the heroes have no idea, and that there's a big potential for some really really bad things to happen. But even by the standards of Hannibal, Hannibal is, you know, he's absolutely, Mads Mikkelsen is absolutely living up to the legacy of Anthony Hopkins. He's far more subdued, but that really works for him. It's you know, he's keeping it consistent with the way he's played the character before. He's not suddenly getting really, really arch. He's just a bit more okay with rubbing people's noses in what he got away with for so long. He still has that phenomenal amount of control over what's going on and this ability to completely mess with people. Not only mess with their heads, but also mess with their lives in really... In ways that are either that are both very subtle and very destructive at once.
And I was going to say, and of course something that somebody in a well appointed but supposedly secure psychiatric facility isn't supposed to be doing that.
Yeah, and that was one of the sort of big things I took away from the episode. The other one was, of course, we had Gillian Anderson's return.
Yes,
we haven't seen her since during the Florence arc, and I'm not 100% sure whether or not she's going to return for the rest, like in the rest of season three. If she doesn't, then this was a fantastic way to send her off by having her sort of finally in a rather oblique way come clean with Will Graham. And have sort of this it's a very twisted a very twisted take on the missus and the ex, to borrow a phrase, because this is arguably the two people in the entire show who have known Hannibal the most intimately.
Absolutely.
Read into that what you will. And Bedelia is kind of bragging about that with Will, just the idea that for all that's happened, she got to be on the other side of the veil when Will Graham did not. And we see what I think is the big reason why in those flashbacks, in which had a great guest appearance from Zachary Quinto, who doesn't have to be the creepiest person in the scene. This idea that the reason Hannibal maybe sort of let Bedelia kind of clump onto him in a way that Will Graham didn't is that Graham kept rejecting the influence of Hannibal as he tried to push Will into becoming a killer. Hannibal kept pushing Will's buttons and Will kept resisting. Whereas here we see that Hannibal really, he pushed Bedelia's buttons. He put her in a situation and she went for it. When the opportunity presented itself, she went for it full throttle. And she talks about the fact that she has just enough of the psychopath in her that she gives the example like an injured bird, I believe it was, but like the fact that her impulse is not to help it, but to kill it.
Yes.
And while she will still help the bird because that's what you're supposed to do, but that's not her first impulse. So Hannibal sets up this scenario, and we don't see Hannibal setting it up, but we just know, we just know from the way it plays out that he set up this scenario that Bedelia sees this dying, you know, this injured bird, and has a chance to indulge in that first instinct. She gets to blame it on self-defense. And she gets to feel like you know, Hannibal helped her and whatnot, and only much later really realized how manipulated it all was. But by that point, she's just too much in his thrall. It was a fantastic scene on the part, you know, on everyone's part. The way that they shot it and they cut it together is that we keep going back and forth between Bedelia and Will in a circumstance that looks very much like the way Hannibal and Bedelia were in their therapy sessions, and we just sort of keep cutting back and forth between Bedelia and Zachary Quinto's character, Neil, I believe was his name, and Bedelia and Will in the present, and just the positioning, the stuff like that. They make it very easy for you to transition between we're in the present, we're in the flashback, but they also keep switching up the positions, the way we see them. It was incredibly well done.
Yeah.
And another example of how Hannibal uses its style, uses some very cinematic techniques to tell you things and draw you into the story and make you understand the themes and the emotions and the character stuff in very nonverbal ways.
Well, it sounds like yet another episode that deserved to be up at the top of the list. So there we are. We'll have to see if the next one, the following week, what turns up at the top. I mean, it can't be Hannibal again, right? I mean, right? Right. Anyway, we're going to go through these last few relatively quickly. We have Sense8, Season 1, Episode 10, What is Human? I'm fairly sure that's a killer song. Anyway, Wolfgang and Leto fight back. Riley goes to see her father play with the orchestra. The rest join her and remember their births. As Riley remembers her past, she passes out and ends up in the hospital. This one came in at an appropriate 8.
Yes.
It is Sense8, after all. Killjoys, yeah. Season 1, Episode 8, Come the Rain. A toxic black rainstorm over Westerly forces John and Powder to take shelter in the Royale, overrun with a gang of dangerous criminals. Meanwhile, Dutch and Davin are trapped on Lucy, coming perilously close to the eye of the storm, among other things as well. Yep, I would say that this was yet another banner episode, coming in at an average of 8. We have Defiant, Season 3, Episode 10, When Twilight Dims the Sky Above. Amanda decides to ignore Nolan's skepticism and welcome an encouraging Botanist Collective delegation to Defiance. Meanwhile, Stama's loyalties are tested by an unexpected arrival, and Tevgen takes another step towards acclimating to life on Earth. This one came in at a 7.83. Let's see. Mr. Robot, Season 1, Episode 7, Viewsource.f. LV. Elliot goes missing. Mr. Robot tries to pull F-Society back together. Angela goes head-to-head with an old nemesis. And this one comes in at an average of 7.67. Now, this one I actually want to know. Does anybody have anything to say with this particular episode? Because this show has been easily one of the best things this summer for me.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's a more... I thought this episode... It definitely wasn't bad by any stretch, but it felt like it was... The pace was a bit stuttered. I mean, this show tends to be a bit more slow paced, but it's more about giving you a chance to explore the characters and let the actors really bring it to create mood and tension and stuff like that. Whereas this episode felt like it was a bit more concerned with plot movements. With okay, we need to set this up. We need to get this done. We need to stuff like that. Like it felt like more of a transitional episode, and I didn't enjoy it quite as much. Although that's not to say that I didn't think it was good or that I did enjoy a lot of the things about it.
Hmm. How about you, Edmund? Anything more to say than that?
Enjoying it, but I guess not getting quite as much of the filler vibe. I can see why Bronson would say that, but there was still enough going on for me to not feel like we were treading water or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. All right, and finally we have Masters of Sex, Season 3, Episode 5, Matters of Gravity. It didn't make it into the bottom three. Isn't that awesome? Johnson's parents visit and insert themselves in the Johnson women's lives. Libby and Masters learn that Johnny has been bullied and try to fix the problem. Johnson finds unexpected excitement in the scent study. A promising fertility patient is found. And this one came in. Edmund, you have it here as a 7.5.
Yeah, it's just in general, it's getting a bit better, but it's still being weighed down by the family stuff for me. But anyway.
Well, there we go. And that brings this particular episode to a close. When we come back next time, we're going to actually get into the most recent week's episodic discussion. That would be the week ending the 18th of August. And we'll see what comes after that. But until next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.